You may say, what'd you do that for? I suppose I could say, because I can. Those are new books that have come out this past year, or that I've obtained this past year, plus a couple of three that have gotten broader circulation since last Easter. This one I think I brought up last Easter. Eyewitness to Jesus. Where are you, camera? Eyewitness to Jesus. I admire Carsten Peter Thiele. And he's written some others. And then now, as I've placed on display down below, the Gospel of Thomas, but now particularly the Jesus Seminar and other people of such like, announced to the world that now you can read the Lost Gospel, the Q document, the German Quell, which means source. Now, I've preached this same message for 28 years, every year, at Easter time. I lost my faith in college, never became against God, just lost my faith. University snatched it from me with an attitude. The attitude was, you can never be an accepted scholar, never gain respect in the academic world, or respect in this world, believing in miracles. In the Roman series that I've been preaching, we spent several months on the first chapter, borrowing from a professor in Berkeley who wrote the little booklet, more than that, a book, first famous for his book about world religions, but then his little book on why religion matters, in which he analyzed this generation as being in a tunnel, the foundation being scientism. Nothing wrong with science. Scientism is a religion. And it dominates the mind of this world that the only thing that exists is what you can see and feel and touch through extensions of sensory apparatus, and that God must be excluded from the thinking, and if there's a God at all, it has to be the deistic situation. He set it in motion one day, and he's been doing something else ever since. You can't be accepted. They worship science as the only method to arrive at truth. And this tunnel we live in, the foundation being scientism, the walls being the educational system that parlays that as the only respected view, that's where I lost my faith, and the legal system that comes out of that educational system and truly does rule ultimately the minds of America. And the ceiling is the media, those talking heads that get religious this time of year and Christmas and don't know what they're talking about. And the basic thing that shook my faith was I could be respected if I would accept Jesus as just another respected founder a religion, a good and wise teacher. Now, you have heard this 28 times. You better act like you're hearing it the first time. Good and wise teacher. That's acceptable. Like Confucius, who founded a religion, more of a philosophic way of thinking. Like Buddha, who founded Buddhism. A prince in India who grew up in the atmosphere of the Eastern religions and their idealistic view of reality as a wheel of life, and that sin basically defines itself with the word tanya, which is thirst, a thirst for things of this world. Salvation, nirvana, is to achieve some kind of unconscious state where you become one with what they won't even define. They call it the that behind all that. To give it a definition is to bring it into being as sensory apparatus knows. The reverse of scientism. You escape from this world and its wheel of life. When you go into a comatosis type state with no feeling or identity with anything here, and if you achieve that, then you quit building karma and the wheel of life stops propelling you onward and you live out what's left of your life and then you become one with the that which is behind all that. That's Eastern religion. I studied under Spiegelberg, probably at the time was the world's expert on Vedanta philosophy from which Buddhism grew. And Dr. Kishimoto from Tokyo University, who took Anasaki's place as the leading Buddhist philosopher of the Far East, here 5 years to study religion here, one of them at Stanford while I was there and did a year's individual study with him. But prior to those experiences, I've told you 100 times probably, I was earning scholarships, top of my class. I don't know a humble way to say that, but it happens to be true. Made the reader of the prof, correcting the tests of the students. And the head of the department in classical history calls me in one day and says, "Gene, I don't understand it. I don't understand it. I look at your grades," and this was early on, "I look at your grades, I see the papers you write, I made you my reader, you're tops in the class. I can't understand how you hang on to this primitive faith in a miracle and your primitive faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God and have these kinds of grades. You can get the foot down on that." He said, "I figured it out." Sort of leaned back, put his hands behind his neck and put his feet up on the desk and had rationalized how he could live with himself having a reader who was the best student in the class but still believed in Jesus Christ. He says, "I figured it out. It has to be some vestigial emotional connection you have with your father." Because he knew about my father pastoring the church in Oroville. That kind of attitude wore me down. And in its place, I was asked to accept Jesus as a good and wise teacher, like these other founders. I've named some: Confucius, Zoroaster, Buddha, Muhammad, etc., Jesus. But I had enough knowledge, and early on figured out, though I learned how to articulate it later, anyone you respect normally will not speak on a subject without being informed. There are two exceptions: politics and religion. A companion professor, I've told you this many times, a companion professor in the school, I had a problem in the Civil War period, a history, I was writing a paper, and it was a debatable situation. And I asked the prof I read for, "Explain it to me." No, Gene," he says, "Civil War," now he was the head of the department and taught the general history classes. "Civil War is not my specialty. Go to Charles Scott," another professor, no relation. "That's his specialty." He wouldn't even speak on a problem in the Civil War without doing his research. But on religion, he can wipe me out and every other budding student by transferring the authority well deserved in his area to a pronouncement about religion. And it was easy to see early on. I had to abandon the faith in Jesus Christ as supernatural, which is the basis of Christianity. The word first named at Antioch, the little Christ, Christians who were followers of Christ, to get respect. But I had a nagging bit of knowledge. The only Jesus that you ever are going to encounter in history went around saying things that prohibit calling him good and wise. He went around saying things that the prince in India, Gautama Buddha, didn't say. Buddha knew he suffered from this condition of thirst, and he tried two ways to solve it. First, he threw himself into sensuality after his family was raised and thought just abandonment into hedonism would wear the thirst out. Some of you probably tried that. My sense of humor slows the message down. That didn't work. So he then tried the way of the yogi. And that's not just for exercise. It's to attain an ability to disengage yourself from identity with yourself and the things around you. And he found this nirvana, this disengagement state, by going through what he called the Eightfold Path. And he never preached himself, never made any ridiculous claims. He said his death meant nothing. When they worried about his departure, he said, "My life means nothing. All I leave you is the way that I followed," which is what they call it. "The way that I followed, it worked for me. You try it. It'll work for you." And on I could go through other founders of religion. They never made claims like that. We have nuts in this country in our history. Father Divine. Various cult leaders that preempt to themselves idiocy of self-image. What my professor was doing, he was defining a Christ that he liked, that he could sell, and he never had looked at the Christ of history. And I said to myself, and I subsequently, as I continued the research of many years, gained the courage to say it to others. Define your source. You're going to tell me Jesus Christ is a good and wise teacher? Well, on what do you base that? Things he said. I'm going to come back with that. Things that he said. Things that he did. Well, now, where do I go to see what he said and what he did? Ironically, 99 out of 100 of them that are trying to sell this idea to you will quote from the Gospels. But I'm saying, and I'm saying it as I've said it every year, and that's why I dump these books out. I don't care what your source. It has to be subjected to at least basic historicity, and whatever your source. Now scholarship is plowed ahead with manuscripts ad infinitum. Nag Hammadi, the Coptic finds, the Dead Sea Scrolls, 40 years and finally coming forth. And it is true. You read the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you will find Matthew and Luke quoting Mark. You will find passages, if you can read the Greek, in Matthew and Luke that differ in the rest of the style that is normal to them. And you will look at Luke and look at Matthew, and this different style, different than Matthew's or Luke's, is the same in these passages. And that's what caused the speculation to come forth, that they must have had some common source of these passages that are identical in Matthew and Luke. You leak over into Mark. So here's Matthew and Luke quoting at times Mark, and quoting at other times a common source. They've been looking for that for over a century. But now, pseudo-scholars are telling you, read the lost gospel. Two. And you could think, until you get inside it, that they found it. All they've done is analyze the common passages, pull them out, and print them in isolation. And now they have the Q, lost Q document, deduced. Not discovered. Deduced. They go and read the original in the manuscripts and the common passages in Matthew and Luke, not in Mark. But Mark had, if there was such a source, he had access to. Not in Mark. They pull these out and print them. Now, the Jesus Seminar, which is a bunch of what I consider to be traitors to scholarship, who want to sell a modern view of Jesus and are parading on all the television programs, never honestly tell you, I can respect a man who looks me in the eye and tells me he thinks I'm a rat. And I might smile and say, well, bigger than any rat you've ever seen. But that's his opinion. But be honest. These so-called pseudo-scholars, which less than 20% of them have any kind of reputation as scholars, and their mouthpiece Croson, they don't tell you. They meet at their meetings, and they've decided already, it doesn't matter what the manuscript says, here is their criteria for authenticity. It can't record a miracle. And they vote with colored balls. And black is out altogether. And they cast votes as they go through sources. If it tells of a miracle, since miracles cannot happen, that's out, black ball. If there's a prophetic utterance, that's out. Because to prophesy is miraculous. And since a prophet can't exist, and prophecy is out of the scientism, naturalism view and can't happen because it's a miracle, that's got to go out. That's got to be fraudulent. Jesus didn't say it. See, they want to like Jesus, but they want to change him. You ever been married to somebody like that? Well, what's worse is when some in-law tries to change him. I'm married to Jesus. I don't like what they're doing to my bridegroom, but they're not honest. Jesus is the only preacher that can't quote Scripture. So if he's quoting the Old Testament, the frame of reference is, it's a prophetic statement, thus a miracle, out it goes. There cannot be any narrative. The prodigal son has to go out. The story of the prodigal son, that has to go out. Because they've already decided. And remember this when I get to the end of this message. That the writers have to be liars. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have to be liars. Because they've decided the Gospels were written middle or late second century. And in some cases, 3rd century. Thus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John couldn't have written it. It's composed 100 years later, 200 years later, with a pseudo-epigram trying to sell the story with a false name. So they're liars. That's given. That's why they're looking for sayings apart from the writer. And since they've already decided these Gospels were written by pseudo-writers giving false names to themselves 100 to 200 years after the events, not an eyewitness, and a second liar because they are representing themselves as eyewitnesses. Remember that, liars. Therefore, They were relying upon verbal, oral transmission, and nobody for 200 years can accurately tell a long narrative story when it's passed on by memory. Of course, I think the Indians of the Southwest can prove differently on that fact. But their assumption is a narrative passed orally will be modified and changed, so prodigal son goes out. On these lists and these criteria, already predetermined what's acceptable. When they finish, you know how much of Mark's gospel's left, the first one? Less than 3%. Voted out a priori. Doesn't what the manuscript says. They totally ignore the work of Thede and others. Cave 7. Dead Sea Scrolls. A passage from Mark. Absolute date. Oh, there's critics that argue against it, but I looked at statistics today on the various proofs. And there's 1.900 trillion chances it could be other than a passage from Mark. Such arguments against it are all Christian literature was in codices. Book form could not be in scroll form, and because these fragments are a part of a scroll, it's like scholars who make a position and then archaeology and facts prove them differently, and they choose the theory over the facts. Mark's gospel, absolute date, buried before 70 A.D. And, of course, they, because they want to exalt the Gospel of Thomas, calling it the fifth gospel, since it only has sayings, and brief ones at that, they want to say, and they accept Thomas, 50 to 60. Well, all other scholars of note say Thomas borrowed from the other scholars, so that pushes the other four gospels back beyond 50 to 60. They totally ignore. Down at the foot of the stairs in the Syriac hexagon is a manuscript. I have a copy of it here. The Gospel of St. Matthew. On display down in the hexagon at the foot of the stairs. The Gospel of Matthew. Well, it's a facsimile that I have, just like the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus, because there's only one in the world. It's in a museum in England. Constantine Simonides. There was discovered fragments, and a sizable fragment, am I boring you? Of a Gospel of Matthew. What is critical is like we have the oldest manuscript in private hands, not a copy, in the big hexagon in the room of the book of the papyri. Hanging up is a passage on a palimpsest written over. Palimpsest means written over because there was a shortage of sheepskin and vellum, but now modern science can pull out what's written under it. 10th or 11th century Coptic commentary. 7th century section of Timothy. But what's important is the colophon page that dates it and identifies it, which is why the British Museum almost died and fought me getting it out of the country when I beat them out in a bid. This, the end of the fifth fragment of the many fragments, contains the latter part of the 28th chapter of Matthew, which reads in Greek, paleographically dated to the first century, and it closes with these words, the writing by the hand of Nicholas the deacon, one of the seven chosen in the book of Acts, at the dictation of Matthew, the apostle of Jesus Christ. It was done in the 15th year after the ascension of our Lord and was distributed to the believing Jews and Greeks in Palestine. That puts it 48 A.D. Now, the people that think God gave the King James to Moses on Mount Sinai are, you know, why are you wasting my time with this? Because the ceiling of this tunnel vision, the media exalts this Jesus seminar state of mind that finds miracles unacceptable, and anything that is a report of a miracle has to be a falsehood because miracles can't occur. And yet they want to reduce everything about Jesus down to just a little package of sayings. I started this side road by saying, go ahead, Jesus Seminar or anybody else. They've defined their source. They're touting the Q document that they've isolated and pulled out. They're touting the Gospel of Thomas, which is not the Q document, but draws from it. What I'm saying, and what kept me from losing my faith totally, I don't care. If you're going to tell me Jesus is a good and wise teacher, tell me your source. Q document? Gospel of Thomas? Where's this Q document again? Where did I throw that thing? Can you get close enough to take a picture of all these things? I voted like the Jesus Seminar with colors. You see that? Can you see it? You get right there. Can you see the little colored tabs? I mean, it's full of them. The dark ones, the green and the blue. The yellow means could be interpreted, maybe not such a ridiculous claim. But all the darker ones, absolutely, one or the other, or more, of the claims I'm going to write on the board. Down in that display of the Gospel of Thomas, the yellow marked paragraphs, read them for yourself. Oh, this is the pablum sayings of Jesus that let you bow at his shrine and not, you know, have much emotional stir-up about it. Because, you know, I still remember the first time my wife, Melissa, heard me preach this message. Not yet. She had grown up as a Catholic. She was so mad through the first half of the message, she thought I was blaspheming. Until the end, and I ask you to wait until the end. I would say, that Sunday began your transformation. Though God had led you for many years before. I'm saying to you, why don't the professors come at me and be as smart as the Jewish leaders? And I'm not talking about a race, I'm talking about the leaders. Power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The leaders. They didn't say Jesus was a good and wise teacher. He comes before Caiaphas. Caiaphas says, reported, you claim to be the Son of God. Is that true? Thou hast said. The only thing in their law that let them rip the high priest's garments apart was blasphemy. Ripped it apart. You need to hear no more. I admire the Jewish leaders. In this sense, they knew that no mortal man could go about saying the things that Jesus said about himself and be both good and wise. Not possible. These other founders never made any of those claims. But no matter where you turn, that's the point I'm making. Go read the yellow passages. No matter where you turn. Okay, you may say, I don't want the Q document. I don't want Gospel of Thomas. I'm going to limit it to just what we can find in the Gospels and in the epistles, the earliest hymns and devotional things that were passed on orally. I don't care. If you're going to say he's good and wise, tell me your source, and I will find in that source Jesus making one or more of the following claims or projecting one or more of the following attitudinal expressions. He seated authority in himself. He didn't go about saying what the prophet said. You never once hear him saying, The Lord said, and behold, I say unto you. You read the prophets, they don't go around saying, behold, I say. They don't go around saying, you've heard it said unto you by all your super spiritual leaders. But behold, I say. The Blessed Sermon on the Mount is full of that. You've heard it said unto you. By whom? They're religious leaders. Thou shalt not kill. But behold, I say. And he intensifies the standard. He never says, the Lord told me to tell you this. I've already mentioned Buddha. Buddha didn't do this. He sold an experience he had. Never said, behold, I say, I did this. This is the result. You try it. Muhammad sure doesn't cede authority in himself. There's one God. Muhammad's his prophet. He speaks from a vision given to him by God. He doesn't cede authority in himself. One of the things the Muslims resent about Christ. And they redraw him just like the Jesus Seminar. He's a prophet in the line of prophets. Muhammad finishes the prophet line. Sorry, no prophet ever ceded authority in himself without an objective external criteria. We have a right to say to people, on what do you base that? Confucius? He made a logical analysis of society. Said, try this, I'll solve your problems. One said he tried it, didn't work. He said, you didn't do it right. They asked him about the next life. He said, I can solve problems this life, so don't ask me about the next one. You never will find any one of these other founders ever ceding authority in himself. Jesus said, if they followed my directions, those who put the yellow markers, he says it back there, you build on what I say, you build on a rock. Build on anything else? You build on sand. I'm just going to now do what the others do. I'm going to pick them out of the Gospels. That's where they go. And I've done enough scholarship to know these Gospels were written by eyewitness writers before 70 A.D. All authority in heaven and earth is given unto me. He had no sense of moral imperfection. No sense of moral imperfection. In other words, he thought he was perfect. Now, I'm not saying he was. If he's God, he is. But the point is, he goes around conveying the attitude, he's perfect. Carlyle says, the greatest of all sins, to be conscious of none. If you ever meet a person that's always right, seeks authority in themselves, you don't make saints out of them. You meet, I've met a few people who think they're perfect. I'm sure not going to make a saint out of them, because in our heart of hearts, we know better. Every other founder set the pattern of prayer. Buddha said, pray my way. Muhammad set the example of the prayer life of the Muslims. They asked Jesus about prayer. And to show you how mixed up the world is, they call it the Lord's Prayer. It's not. His prayer's in John 17. They asked him about prayer. He said, when you pray, say this. He's the only founder of religion that never prayed the prayer he committed to his disciples. Because he couldn't pray it. To pray it is to violate what exuded from him. He'd have to say, forgive our trespasses. He had none. And whether he did or didn't, you can debate all you want. He didn't think he did. Some will quickly get the phrase and say, well, remember the one that came to him and said, good master. He said, why callest thou me good? There's none good but God. Right. Don't call me good with your warped and infantile view that thinks that you too can be good, which was the problem of the rich young ruler who said, I'm behind in none of these things. Don't come strutting up to me thinking that there's a goodness that you can achieve in the flesh on your own, because the question that is asked repeatedly by the rich young ruler is, what more can I do? Don't strut up to me and call me good unless you also recognize I'm God. For only God can be good. Wherever he turns, forgive sins. No prophet ever did that. The prophet says, the Lord forgive you. Jesus looks at the woman that everyone wants to stone and says, thy sins are forgiven. Linked to his authority and his moral self-consciousness is the way he judges people. He looks at the religious leaders of his day and says, you're like a grave painted over, outwardly looking good, but inside full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. He calls the religious leaders, and I wish I could really literally translate some of his Greek words, hypocrites, strain out the gnat and swallow the camel. Can't make it in yourself and keep everybody else from going in. He judges without a qualm. You got to be perfect to judge. I don't care how evil you may be. I've seen deacons carrying on affairs, extramarital affairs, and they're the worst judges to put on a board. And they'll really take it out on somebody else that's guilty. If you want a thief to write the term of prison for a thief, get a thief to make the sentence. But in our heart of hearts, every one of us knows we're not perfect enough to pass judgment on other people's standing with God. He never hesitated. He never once go through all these sources. Find me anywhere in any of these sources where Jesus exhibits an ounce of humility about his moral perfection. His prayer in John 17 reeks with spiritual pride, which from any other voice except the perfect voice is the sin of all sins. Father, I've done what you sent me to do. I've delivered the word to him. Now restore to me the glory that I had with you. Not the slightest sense of moral imperfection, or rather moral, not the slightest sense of imperfection. Not an ounce in his words. Did I do all right, Father? Absolute moral, presumptive perfection is his self-image. You don't make saints of people like that. None of these people ever did that. Buddha sought his eightfold way and found it because of his sense of moral imperfection. Never would Muhammad suggest that he was perfect. He was just the mouthpiece of God through the visions that God gave him. Only Jesus makes these ridiculous claims. He talked of eternity from the inside. Am I boring you? Inside eternity. You know, this is not a church where people come and park their brain. That's what's wrong with most of Christianity. They think you don't have to use your brain to be a Christian. Well, my Bible says this is life eternal. That a man may know thee. Not just feel thee. Know thee. The one true God. And Jesus Christ whom he has sent. What do you think of me as your pastor? If I walked out here today and said, I've been holding back, now I'm going to tell you the truth. I was there when Satan was cast down. I was there. I saw him cast out. Before Abraham was, I was. Well, now I got to be spiritualizing or something. No? I was there before Abraham was. He talks of heaven with such familiar tones. It would be like you questioning me if I tell you how many books I got in my study. Or telling you some other familiar spot that's my favorite place. He doesn't do what Muhammad did. Tell you about a vision of heaven, very attractive to desert men. I mean, you know, these poor Arabs, if they think they could handle 70 virgins, they really are nuts. You know, I mean, you got to hand it to whoever gave him that vision. That vision giver knew what made a desert rat tick. He hadn't been there. He just would... wanting to go, I'm sure, after God got done telling him what it was like. Only a nut or a fraud would try to convince me that he had been there, was here temporarily, and was going back. He talks about how the angels act when somebody converts. He doesn't say, I had this vision, or the Lord told me this. You're supposed to believe because he's been there. And this is temporary, and he's going back. And furthermore, he's going to prepare a place for us and come and get us and take us there. Well, now, in this context, throw somebody clapping back there because he's a believer. But remember the frame of reference. Good and wise teacher, but not supernatural. Well, now, what kind of scientist and power has taken him up there and brought him here? He's not a good and wise teacher. You can't be a good and wise teacher. Go around making these stupid claims about yourself. He put himself, the center of the religious universe, self. Buddha preached the way that worked for him. Confucius, the logical analysis of society. Try it, it'll work. Muhammad, the pillars of Islam revealed to him in a dream. Follow that. Jesus preached himself. Come back there and read the yellow mark things. Wherever you encounter him, he's putting himself the center of the religious universe. He didn't say, do what I say. That's what these modernists are trying to do, is separate his sayings from himself. He could have said that plus the 21-volume Oxford English Dictionary in 75 languages. Wouldn't save a rat. He could have lived another 33 years. And his life wouldn't save anybody. And he had the chance, in his prayer of perfection assumed, to go back without finishing his course. This was pictured in the Old Testament passage of the perfect servant, who works out his time and can go free. But he goes to his master and says, because he had children during that tenure, and a wife, said, I love my wife and my children. I don't want to leave them. I want to be with them. So he had to go to the post of the door and have his ear nailed to that post, the symbol of hearing and obedience, in order to save his family. All of Jesus' teaching wouldn't get anybody in. Every healing he performed, every forgiving act he did, was drawing down chips on what would break the barrier between God and man because of our sins. And he knew that he was the center. He was going to rescue them. He put himself the center of the religious universe. He said, follow me, come unto me, forsake all and come after me. Don't prefer father, mother, wife, children, or anything, including yourself, to me. I'm the door. There's no other door. You go in any other way, you're thief and robber. I'm the door of the sheepfold. I am the good shepherd. He never went by the fisherman and said, I got a plan for you and a way that will work for you. Follow me. And straightway they forsook their net. He put himself the center, and you would vote me out in a hurry if I walked out here and said to you, the only way you're getting to heaven is putting me the center of your life. There's no other door. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And by me, you enter in. Only a nut talks that way. He said, there's something wrong with the world. Something wrong with the world. Can't be fixed. World wrecked. Can't be fixed. Any way other than he dies. And he dies in a context with listeners who understood the meaning of a ransom. A ransom, a price paid to restore something that was lost, to have that which is condemned to death spared. A price paid to get what has been lost and to let that which is to die live. And he said the whole world got something wrong with it. They cannot be set right except by his death. And then mind-boggling of all, he said, after he died, he would rage. Not randomly, specifically. To a people, by the way, except for some scattered bands among the Essenes, that did not believe there would ever be a resurrection until the general resurrection at the end of the world. One of the major battles between the Sadducees and others. He would rise. 72 hours later, 3 days, he asked for a sign. He said, don't be any sign. The only sign God about to give you, to Jonah, as the type in the whale, 3 days and nights in the belly of the whale, brought out miraculously. He got people confused who thought he was talking of the temple. They said, 48 years it took to build this. He said, you destroy this temple, talking of his body. It will rise again in 3 days. Now, I like you, Cal. But I think if you went around saying these things about yourself, I'd put a disqualifier when I came on your station. I might postpone it a while to go to your wife and say, can we talk to Cal? Well, now, Craig Lamp's a super salesman. But he tries selling himself to me like this. Me and your son are going to take you out in the backyard. I think the two of us could handle him. I mean, he can continue to believe this stuff about himself. But he's going to be in isolation for a while. The point is, you don't talk like this. Good and wise teacher, he's a nut or a fake. He can be one or the other. This is what C.S. Lewis calls the startling alternate. He can be good, but crazy, believing this stuff about himself. But he can't be wise. Because a wise man knows no man can make these claims. He could be wise enough to fool everybody, but he knows it's not true. It's con. Therefore, he can be good at it, convincing people that it's true. But he knows better. And thus, he can't be good. What have I proven? Most of these smart alecks. That's a Christian way of saying what they really mean. Most of these smart alecks that looked down on, and did look down on me in college, that would accept me if I bowed to their wisdom and elevated Jesus to the high chair of being one of these respected founders of religion, didn't know beans about what they were talking about. And I could still respect them in their field, but they revealed by what they offered to me as the alternate, they didn't know anything about the only Jesus that exists in history. But I'm telling you, Cal and Craig, if you made these claims, including the third day after your death, you're coming out of that grave, and you come out of that grave, and I'd be like Thomas, touch the wounds, I'm taking another look at you, because that's all the definition of God I need. All authority, perfect. He knows where we're all going because he's been there, at least the heavenly part, and controls the other one. He is the center. I don't have to go through some never-ending pursuit of reality and truth. He's it. Three words from him is worth more than 45 philosophers and 50 volumes. I don't need any definition of God beyond that. And if you said that and came out of the grave, I'm bound at your feet as Thomas did in saying, my Lord and my Christ. So, when I recognize this was the alternate, either do as they did in the first century, call him a blasphemer, a fake, or a nut. If he came out of that tomb, he's neither a fake nor a nut. He's what he says he is. And that's enough starting point for faith in God for me to get going. So I had to settle the resurrection. I got 18 minutes to settle the resurrection. Took me 3.5 years. If we're going to talk about it, you're going to have to accept some other facts. Most people don't want to be disciplined when they talk religion. But if you're going to discuss whether what I preached today was interesting and worth the time you spent here, whether it was long or short, you've got to assume that I was here and you were there or somewhere and I was preaching. Don't discuss whether I preach something interesting, something right, something bad, long or short, if after we get done talking, I wasn't even here. Intelligent discussion has to presume a frame of reference built one upon another as you engage in discussion and evidence hunting. There's no reason to talk about the resurrection if you don't accept Jesus lived. Now, Tacitus, the heathen Roman historian, accepts that. We're going to write in code to speed up. Jesus lived. Now, we're talking about a historic figure, not some mythical figure. Very few people debate that today. But I want to tell you something. It's much easier to prove the historic fact that Jesus lived than to prove the resurrection. I mean, if your faith depends upon proving the resurrection or proving Jesus lives, and you're okay if you can just get proof that he lived, well, there's more proof of him than there is of Caesar or about any other historic person in the history of mankind. But I'm not debating that today. You have to assume it if we're going to talk about the resurrection. I mean, how can you talk about a guy raising from the dead if you don't believe he lived? He's got to live and die. He was crucified. You have to assume that fact. Hands of the Romans, instigated by Jewish leaders. Not the Jews as a people, Jewish leaders. Three, he was considered dead. I'm not saying he was, but he was considered dead. I know there's a theory been going around that he practiced with Lazarus and faked his death on the cross, and he wasn't really dead. But he was considered dead by most of history. He was buried in a known, accessible tomb. Five, he was preached in the same place where he lived and was crucified, raised, ascended, in a tomb empty. Or I should just say empty tomb. That was preached. I'm not saying it's true. Just saying it was preached. Six, if the Jewish leaders brought about his crucifixion by their charges that he was a blasphemer, I think if he were not God, their charges were accurate because of the claims he made. And he comes out of the tomb, they're out of a job. Not just an intellectual problem to them. They're out of a job. And I think we're watching in the war in Baghdad how quickly people will stone somebody when they get a chance to do it. Revenge. If these priestly leaders and these Pharisees who accused him confront the reality of the resurrection, if it happened, they're out of business. Their spiritual authority and their bread and butter and their livelihood is at stake. That makes you more interested than just a philosopher. That's axiomatic. So the Jewish leaders were more concerned than we would have 2,000 years removed to disprove this when it starts to be preached. Number seven, it's beyond argument that those who preached it at the first were persecuted horribly for the message. Persecution. Every record. Don't tell this story anymore. Persecution to those who preached it. Number eight. How did I get down this far? Number eight. That's where I want to be. Because the Jewish leaders were more concerned, this is deduction, to disprove it than we would be. If the body were in the tomb, they could have shut up all the preachers in one stroke by going and producing the body. So the tomb was empty. There wasn't any body there. Their livelihood, their bread and butter, their spiritual authority, their leadership, their position, everything was at stake. And here in the very city where they brought about his crucifixion for blasphemy, they're preaching he's out of the tomb. And what he said would happen, happened. Where do you think you, as a common sense man, if you were one of those Jewish leaders with more concern, would go? You would go to the known, accessible tomb to produce the body. Those facts have to be assumed for me to discuss the resurrection. Because if you don't believe the resurrection and you want to change the focus, each one of these is easier to prove than the resurrection event. The resurrection event validates, as Paul said to the philosophers on Mars Hill, all the claims of Jesus. And because that's known, every kind of theory in the world has been proposed to explain that empty tomb and the preaching of this message. The first one was by the Jewish leaders themselves. They said, the disciples stole the body and now are telling you this lie. Okay. Disciples stole it. One theory, the first one, from the Jews. Romans took it. That's Croson and the Jesus Seminar people. Jesus' body gets thrown out in the ash heap and eaten by dogs. Well, even a dog takes a while to eat it. But that's their theory. Romans took it. Three, Jewish leaders took the body. Four, women went to the wrong tomb. You know, it was dim light. And they went to the wrong tomb at the start of the day. And they saw an empty tomb and they thought Jesus was risen. And they ran off like excited women. And there was no resurrection. It was the wrong tomb. They resuscitated. They took him down from the tomb, but he wasn't really dead. And therefore, in the coolness of the tomb, they took him down from the cross. He wasn't really dead. And in the coolness of the tomb, he resuscitated. There ain't anybody ever resuscitated from a Roman crucifixion. Doesn't happen. But, go ahead, it's a theory. 6. Hallucinations. That's become the most popular. Hallucinations. I can line up psychologists on this platform by the dozen that will tell you you can't have hallucinations without a certain state of mind. And you can't have hallucinations without something in your prior experience feeding it. And hallucinations do not occur to diverse people in diverse places all the same. And I can go on with another list. I got a PhD minor in educational psychology from Stanford, which is a pretty good school. You don't have hallucinations in the state of mind that these disciples were in. And you sure don't have diverse, large group hallucinations like that. But, okay, hallucinations. I'm arguing, but we'll just leave it there. 7. Acquainted with the first one, they just lied. They bet on the wrong horse and they're embarrassed. They staked their lives on Jesus. They believed his claims. And he defrauded them. But like the concern of the Jewish leaders to disprove it because their religious position's at stake, now these disciples that have enjoyed the preeminence of being next to Jesus, they bet on a loser. So they got to fabricate this story. And some argue that the reason there's 7 weeks between his death and resurrection story and the day of Pentecost, when the church, they took the 7 weeks to concoct this story. They're just lying. Made the whole thing up to save face. 8. True. They're just honest, simple reporters telling what they experienced. Now, just like, I don't care, you can create any kind of Jesus you want. And I've been telling you, if Jesus is not what he said he was, I don't need him. I prefer Confucius' golden rule. If there is no God and there is no Jesus and there is no miracle and there is no heaven, don't you dare try to do to me what you want done to you. I want Confucius' golden rule. Don't do to me. Don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. I'm safe with that. Just get out of my face. Don't come with a Bible doing what you... I don't need Jesus if he didn't come out of that tomb. And these poor guys, they believed him. And as I repeat, C.S. Lewis said, there's only 2 choices. He's either what he claimed, or he's a nut, or he's a fraud. You've got that startling alternate. Likewise, I don't care. The reason I accepted these theories. There's only 2. Oh, you can take a theory and never do any more research and feel comfortable with it. But if you're going to use your brain, be honest, there's only 2 choices again. Another startling alternate. There's only 2. All the rest is just... I got to find a word I can use here. Just... self-serving BS to try to avoid the agonizing encounter with the truth. You've got to make a choice. That's what Jesus forces upon everybody once you encounter him, the true Jesus of history. You've got to choose. He's either a nut or he's what he said he was. On the resurrection, there's only 2 choices. Take these facts for granted. They either lied or told the truth. You're forced again to an agonizing choice. You don't have any choice other than that. Disciples stole the body. Okay, they lied. Romans took the body. No. With the concern of the Jewish leaders and their capacity to have the Romans act as the executioner, and the body would disprove everything. They had the ability to go to the Romans and say, "Where's the body? We want to shut these people up." They had to explain to the Romans the disciples took the body. They stole it. Jewish leaders took the body. That's nonsense. It's just plain nonsense. Because all they had to say is, instead of saying the disciples stole the body, is, "Here, look at him. He's still dead." If there was a body in the tomb, their concern would have taken him there. And the wrong tomb has exploded because they buried him in a known accessible tomb from a prominent member of the Sanhedrin, Joseph of Arimathea. Resuscitation, you don't do that, I've already said. You just don't do it. But they didn't just preach an empty tomb. They preached a raised, vital, healthy Christ, vital and participating in food with him, not a recoverer from a crucifixion. Ascension was as much a part of their preaching as the resurrection. So they still are guilty of being liars and adding on. Every one of these still reduced down. They're either lying, even if tenable. None of these theories explain the total preachment, including ascension and the multiple appearances. They would only explain the empty tomb. You got to choose. In 5 minutes, I'll tell you why I made the choice they were telling the truth. One, cataclysmic change in the reporters. A lie can change someone. I've seen it happen. Enough of the better. Every one of these, by any psychological criteria, became better. Peter, impetuous, undependable, unstable, always with his mouth ahead of his head. He couldn't get on the right track, just uncontrollable. Jesus wants to wash their feet and tells them he's going to wash their feet. And Peter, no. You know, it's impressive that he loves his master that much. "You don't wash my feet. I wash your feet, or you don't make it in the kingdom with me." "Huh, wash me all over." Jesus talks of the cross, and he'll correct him. "Be it far from you." Jesus talks of being betrayed. "Not me, Lord. They can kill me. I won't betray you." 3 times before sunrise. Jesus sends a special message to him after the resurrection. "Go tell my disciples and Peter. And Peter. Make sure he gets the message. I'll meet you at Galilee." Jesus is a little bit late. Peter says, "I go fishing." He becomes the rock that preaches the message on the day of Pentecost. Something changed him. Changed him until he would ask to be crucified upside down, not feeling worthy of his master. James and John are called sons of thunder. Not the brother of Jesus. We're talking about the other James. They would call down fire from heaven on somebody that opposed them. High-tempered, nicknamed sons of thunder, selfish, wanting the best seat in the kingdom, and low-life enough to send their mother to ask for it. After some event, namely this resurrection event, John becomes the epitome of love. They took James's head too soon. for him to demonstrate. So he demonstrated his faithfulness, but John becomes the embodiment of love. Contrast, cataclysmically, Thomas, consistently doubting. He's got to see, he's got to feel, he's got to have proof. He doesn't think Jesus is supernatural. He's just attracted to him. Jesus says, I must needs go through this place. It's a danger zone. Thomas speaks up and says, let us go with him, that we may die with him. Thomas realistically knew the threat, and he wasn't about to not help out. Give him credit for courage and love, but a very naturalistic view of his master, because he thought Jesus would actually be killed, in spite of the fact that Jesus said, no man taketh my life from me. I do it. I lay it down. Jesus is preaching of heaven, eternity. From the inside, he's telling, I go away. Better for you to go away. And I'm going to go prepare mansions for you. And then, after I prepare mansions for you, I'll come and get you and bring you to myself. The rest of them are already having a Pentecostal hoedown at the word mansions. Now, hear another word. Thomas is listening. He didn't want to miss this. And he butts in. We don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? Because he went on to say, prepare a mansion for you and the way you know. And Thomas said, no, we don't. We don't know the way. I mean, it sounds good, but give me the roadmap. Now, I once said, as I began to get my faith back, if I didn't believe in the resurrection, I'd worship the guy that wove this pattern. Scattered in different parts of the Roman Empire, not even knowing that other people would read it, they wove these pictures in the various reports. And who is doubting at the resurrection? Same guy. I won't believe, lest I put my hands in the print of these execution spots. Same Thomas. Consistently, through different reports, hard head. And Jesus didn't, and I hung on to this during my years of doubt. Jesus didn't say, he said, more blessed to believe without seeing. That's common sense. You don't have any problems with doubt. Man, you're just sailing along like a goonie bird. But he didn't deny him the proof. That's what kept me going. He said, behold my hands and my side. And Thomas fell to his face and said, my Lord and my God. Cataclysmically changed. Carries the gospel to the most doubting area of the world, pierced with a Brahmin sword near Madras, India. Takes a family to not believe in you. The members of his own family wanted to oppose him, thought he was crazy, like I parodied my two friends. Something changed John, or James rather. Something changed him. His own, as this manuscript and the records will show, Joseph had sons by another woman named Mary. She died and he was espoused to Mary the Virgin when the angel came. This is not an argument for the virgin birth. The resurrection gives you a logical basis for believing the virgin birth. But the family did not. And the ultimate change, no man ever exhibits in history a profound change like the Apostle Paul. He never traveled with the historic Jesus. He was only taught by the resurrected Jesus. And he was an enemy. One of the arguments people give against the resurrection, they say, well, the only people who report the resurrection, the only ones that tell you about it, the only record we have are from believers. Well, now, if he came up through this platform right now and walked out there and said, touch me, would you still be doubting? You become a believer. Intrinsic evidence. Intrinsic evidence. Inside historic criteria whereby you decide whether a historian is telling you honest truth or fabricating a story. Abundant in the records. One of the most obvious, everybody agrees, Peter was the source for Mark. And if this is a bunch of fakers making up a lie to save face, that kind of personality is not prone to let himself be painted as badly as Mark paints him. You can read all the Gospels. Mark's the shortest. Peter's failures and mess-ups are more numerous in the Gospel of Mark than anywhere else. I think I know why. Because Mark ran away the night of the crucifixion. He then was too soft to go up into Turkey with Paul and Barnabas. And Paul had to run him away back home, and his relative Barnabas helped him. And I'm quite sure that Mark, as he sat around with Peter, his mentor, would say, because Mark believed, if you take my frame of reference, how can God ever forgive me for what I've done? And I can hear Peter saying, well, wait, I'll tell you what I did. And God let me preach the message on the founding day of the church. If this were a fraud, and these are liars, what advantage for Peter to let himself be so portrayed? And don't come back with some rhetoric that says, you've just shown how the personalities are woven. Different ones, different writers. Mixed through all. Little historic incidents like, where do we buy bread? The incident before the miracle of feeding. And he says, ask Philip. But you have to go to another gospel written another place by these liars to find out that was the logical choice, because Philip was called from Bethsaida. Three different records will tell you where he is, who he asked, and where he was called. Historic, honest reporting. If they're making up a lie, the Latin, you can't hardly get into the first century. The last person you would want to be the first witness of the resurrection, women. They were not even allowed to testify in court. This is not some present. I mean, you know, look up the word chauvinism in the dictionary, and Gene Scott's written there. So don't, you know, it's a bluff, because I know women are superior, and that's why I will never let them have anything free from me. Because once they get on top, they ain't ever getting off. While we're ahead, men, stay there. Feminists, you're right, but I'm against you. And I will die for you. Get on top. That's, you see. Now, the point being, this is not an anti-feminist speech. This is the first century. You don't use women. I want to tell a story to save face. And my first witness, women, kind of hard. Unless you can think like the Taliban. You don't. You're telling a lie. You're not telling the truth. So get somebody credible to discover the empty tomb. With the hatred that existed in that century, that day, between the Jews of the Sanhedrin who condemned Jesus and the Christians, you don't write into a lie. Joseph of Arimathea, from a little rinky-dink town as his birthplace, though he became very prominent in the Sanhedrin and with Pilate, you don't have a member of the Sanhedrin showing him kindness and taking him down and leaving the two thieves there and putting him in his new tomb. That don't fit. That just doesn't fit the lie. Mark, everybody agrees, was writing to Egyptians or to Romans. Gentiles. To a Gentile, son of man means he had an earthly father. To a Jew, son of man was the most pregnant and powerful messianic term you could use. They, in the apocalyptic writings of that day, they feasted on Enoch and Daniel, where the son of man comes in clouds of glory to set up his kingdom down here as Messiah. Now, if I'm a liar, writing to a bunch of Romans and a bunch of Egyptians, trying to prove that Jesus is the Son of God, and I'm lying, why not have him call himself that? Why have him call himself Son of Man? Go read your Gospels. More, the shortest Gospels, Mark, and more than any other Gospel, Jesus is calling himself Son of Man, and Mark is the one having him say it, which defeats the purpose to a strange Gentile audience of presenting him as the Son of God. I could go on for hours, and I've already gone over my allotted time. I could go on for hours. Historians will say they're not writing like liars. The 7 weeks, why wait 7 weeks? It didn't take 7 weeks to make this story up. It was very simple. One sentence, Peter preached it. This Jesus, whom you crucified, hath God raised up, having loosed the pains of death. Doesn't take 7 weeks to memorize that speech. They're honest people who were told by Jesus, don't preach. I'm risen now, but you need power, so don't you preach. You go to Jerusalem, you wait till I undo you with power. And these simple-minded people who are lollygagged, they never believed he was going to raise, which is another reason why they couldn't have hallucinations. They did what he said. Even though, in later years, this is used to somehow cloud the truth. I'm telling you, they don't write like liars. Number three, you don't pay that kind of price, as the facts over here have it. You don't pay the price they paid for a lie. Every one of them, save John, died a martyr's death. Every one of them. And there's an irony in that. Because of all the disciples, John's the only one that's there at the cross. The rest of them fled, fearing for their lives. So God has a way of getting even. All the ones that fled died a martyr's death. John stayed there, lived old age, and died a natural death. So feast on that this afternoon. That may be the only thing you've heard that you didn't hear in the other 28 messages. Price! You don't pay this! I can believe that you can have fun trying to save face, but not when somebody's stripping you alive of your skin, whipping you, flaying, as your skin an animal, flaying you to death, as Bartholomew was. Not when you're crucified upside down, as Peter was, and on that St. Andrew's cross, the most painful kind of crucifixion, as Andrew was, it gets its name from that. Not burned and strangled, as Matthew was. Not dragged to death in the streets of Alexandria as Mark was, and not hung by idolatrous priests up in Greece as Luke was, and on I might go, pierced with a sword in India as I referred, as Thomas was. You don't pay that kind of price for a lie. But if you did, St. Thomas Aquinas, great proof, they died alone. I could believe this morning that we could stage a scene where Marty Tharp and Cal Brack and Craig Lamp, well, we have believed this, and they killed our master. And he said he'd come out. And that's the only thing that can vindicate us. So we figure out how to get this done, even if we steal the body. And we concoct this story to save face. He raised. I can believe if the three of us, four of us, stayed together, there is such a thing as group pressure that can perpetuate a lie. Because you don't want to be the one that lets the others down. You're not going to break and say it's all a lie. But separate us. Continents apart. You be Peter up in Rome. You be Bartholomew in Armenia. You're going to be scandalized and you're going to be crucified. You be Matthew. You're going to be tied to a stake and strangled over in Parthia. You're Bartholomew. And I'm Andrew or Thomas, any one of the others. And I'm in this place telling this story, and I'm going to be done to as you, each of these different kinds. You're not going to know I let you down. You're Bartholomew. You can get out of being skinned alive. And it was all a game. I'm sorry. Sorry, sir. How will he know it? He's over in Rome. They don't have television. You don't have embedded reporters. He ain't going to know. How will Cal know where he is? And he got the same choice. He's alone. And he's facing that test. You're facing your test, and I'm facing mine. Nobody's going to find out. We don't expect this to become a Bible. We know we're lying. We're just saving face. But we're separated. No telephone, no cell phone, no internet. No way that any one of us in the current contemporary scene will be found out. And each one of us, horrible persecution to death, one of us is going to break. I may come and see you. Boy, I'm going to tell you, Craig, they did me some terrible things, but I stuck to my guns. I didn't let us down. They whipped the shavings out of me. Of course, none of you are going to be around to tell the story, but if you lied, you can go, boy, they whipped me good, but I stuck to it. As Thomas Aquinas says, it's psychologically impossible to believe that not one of these people, if this is a concocted lie, that not one of these people would break under the pressure and say, hey, it ain't so. There's 2,000 years, and you can start another 2,000 years. Maybe you'll be the first. Not one shred of evidence anywhere in history that any one of these disciples, dying a martyr's death, ever retracted on this testimony. I remember going through this with Larry Thomas, my major professor, the president of the American Philosophy of Education Teachers across America, Stanford. I was his assistant at the time, doing my final stages of my doctorate with him. I said, Larry, no man I've ever met, I respect your integrity like you, and you live by a philosophy to look at evidence. But I said, take me kindly. You live a life and preach a philosophy that denies the validity of Jesus Christ, and I've been with you enough and asked a few subtle questions to know that I can ask you 5 questions more, and you will reveal you've never spent 5 hours looking at the evidence the way you look at other subjects for the resurrection. He said, well, Gene, can you give me a couple hour source? I said, no, but I'll tell you what got me. I'm pleased to know that he ultimately came to the Catholic faith, which believes in the resurrection. But I went over it with him, and when I finished, I said, Larry, this is the tantamount proof. They died alone without ever one of them reneging to their death. He says, I'm convinced. Those men believed what they were saying. Therefore, Gene, there's got to be something wrong with your other 8 facts. I said, I got you, because those 8 are easy compared to this one. The option, I laid a book down, the last one, after 3.5 years, and I said, there's no other answer. He came out of that tomb. That puts me out in left field from the scientists and the academicians. Because if he came through that rock and through that door and sailed off, he controls the universe. Molecular displacement's nothing. The promise, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. He's with me. And I have someone with me who promises to be in me that had a right to make these claims. That's all the God I need. And for these however many years, I set out on a journey. If I could find, so I collect the manuscripts. If I could find, he said it. And if I find, as I went through the Old Testament, he used this as the oracle of God, I'll build my life on it. Well, you witnessed a few months ago, and recently, I had the choice, said it to my wife. I preach faith, and I preach miracles, and I preach the reality of God's promises. I don't have a choice. I have to keep walking that way, and I'm closer home than I was a long time ago. God kept his word to the greatest risker of all. Jesus had fewer promises from his Father than you and I have. Just one promise. If he would do this for his Father to redeem us, God would raise him from the dead, give him a name above every name. I've oft at this Easter season thought on the cry he gave on the cross, Father, why hast thou forsaken me? He committed himself in trust that God would do what he said. But even in that last breath, he experienced what through the eternities he had never experienced, separation from and receipt of God's wrath for you and me. And it hit him. Every record of the resurrection is very precise. From the day of Pentecost to every record through the book of Acts. Very specific. You killed him. You killed the Prince of Life. You hung him on a tree. But God raised him up. God raised him up. This same Jesus hath God raised up. He hung his life on that promise. And God raised him up, and he sits at his right hand, and God gave to him everything. That's the example of faith. Faith is action based on belief sustained with confidence. I came to a conclusion. He came out of that tomb, and that means he has a right to make these claims, and that means that my life is centered and can only be centered in him, and I'm not sorry. I made that choice that fateful day, and I intend to end my life, whenever it comes, as Paul. I've been faithful. I've kept the faith. Henceforth, there's laid up for me a crown. I recommend you make the same choice, and that's my message today. Offering time. All right, you may be seated. I went over, I'm sorry. But I had a choice of doing it in two sessions or one. Just think of the task my wife has to cut this down to 1 hour for Dallas. You don't have to stop thinking to be a Christian. You don't have to have some euphoric, holy glow come around you. Just make a tough decision. He came out of eternity, took a tent of human flesh, showed us what God is like in his own nature, died for our sins, and rose again to empower us to follow him. Christianity is focused on Jesus, and it begins with a miracle. Paul said, if Christ be not risen, we're frauds, we're fakes, we're liars because we've testified that God raised him from the dead. Half of Christianity doesn't believe the resurrection. It's just an intellectual thing. They don't really believe it. If you did, you'd believe in miracles in your own life. You'd hang your body on it. That's why you need to be at the Shalom service tonight at 8 o'clock as we go around the table of the Lord and remember what this Jesus did for us. That's offering time. The Bible tour will start. The buses will wait. We pay for them. So they'll wait. And you that want to go on the Bible tour, can you handle it?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Lamp, the song that's going to close us out. Hard to find a song to go with this message, but I think Stranger in Town will do it.